Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. That typhoon that just struck the Philippines, delegates taking part in UN talks on a global climate treaty were quick to blame global warming for the intense devastation. But is there a link? Some scientists urge caution in making a connection between global warming and any single storm like the typhoon in the Philippines. There is, however, broad agreement that rising temperatures on the planet will trigger more powerful storms. We begin this morning with Justin Gillis, the award-winning environmental reporter for The New York Times. Justin, so good to have you. Welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you.
So the typhoon that struck the Philippines, it's believed to have killed 10,000 people in one city alone. How responsible, ultimately, was global warming for what happened over there?
The truthful answer is we do not know.
Yeah.
And the scientists are probably going to spend years trying to figure that out. With most of these big dramatic climate events, we do eventually get an answer or at least a quasi-consensus in the scientific literature, but it can take years. And I mean, we know some general things that we can say. We know that ocean surface temperatures are rising. That is, of course, the basic fuel for storms like this. And so it's entirely plausible that this storm, was made worse by global warming. But there's no great scientific certainty about that right now.
You know, there appears, though, to be little question that global warming isn't helping the cause here, the cause being more intense storms more frequently. We know that, don't we?
Well, it's a bit more complicated than that. The predictions are that we will actually see fewer storms through time as a result of global warming, but the ones we do have may be more intense. Now, this thing in the Philippines, one of the reasons that people are suspecting a global warming fingerprint, if you will, is that this may have been the strongest storm sort of ever to hit land in the historical record. It's pretty close in wind speed to Hurricane Camille, which hit the United States in 1968, if I'm recalling it, which was a very, very intense storm. So this thing was measured. There's some uncertainty about the accuracy of the measurements, but it was measured as high as 195 miles per hour near landfall. So that's quite a powerful storm.
Why would there be a connection between fewer storms and global warming if we think that global warming is making for intense storms?
Temperature differentials are part of what drives the creation of hurricanes and typhoons. So, for instance, as the temperature differential between the tropics and the poles are warming up faster than the tropics. As that temperature differential decreases, we may see fewer storms being formed. I mean, a hurricane or a typhoon is just a fancy way of moving heat around the planet, essentially. So we may see fewer of them being formed, but when they do form, there's going to be sort of more energy available at the sea surface to fuel them. So, you know, what these computer programs, the climate models say is most likely sort of fewer storms, but stronger ones. Now, I have to say that is, you know, one of the less certain predictions about global warming. We have varying degrees of confidence in these predictions we've made, and the picture of what's going to happen with storms is one of the murkier issues.
I was going to say the notion that global warming is sort of this new phenomenon on our planet that begins to explain why scientists, I imagine, can't predict with any more certainty in terms of what all this means, Justin.
It's a young science. There's no question about that. And it's almost like events on the ground are sort of outrunning the science itself. We are scrambling to catch up and understand what we're seeing unfold in front of our eyes.
Justin Gillis, who covers the environment for The New York Times, is our guest. There's a push on, and you've written about this, Justin, to develop and implement a new treaty to replace this, you know, it's been described as a lackluster Kyoto Protocol by 2020. How likely is that we'll get a new treaty, and where would this country come down on a new treaty like that one?
It's a really good question. There's a sort of desperate desire, I think, to come up with something better than Kyoto, which turned out to be quite a weak treaty.
Yeah.
And as you'll recall, the United States refused to even ratify it.
Huge fight over it, right?
Huge fight over that. So the goal is to come up with a new treaty that would be finished in Paris by 2015 and then take effect in 2020. We don't know yet if the negotiations are going to work. We certainly don't know whether anything effective is going to emerge. And we definitely don't know whether, the United States Senate could be persuaded to ratify it. It would depend on, it's several years before that treaty is likely even to come before the Senate. And we don't know what the composition of the Senate will be then and so forth. So it's anybody's guess, really.
You know, you wrote a story last month that concluded this, that by the middle of this century, temperatures across much of the Earth will rise to the point that the coldest year will be warmer than the hottest years from the past. Let me say that again. The coldest year will be warmer than the hottest years from the past. Wow.
Yeah, we're sort of, in some sense, already getting there. I mean, this year globally, I mean, it's been a fairly cool year actually in the United States following, last year, which was the hottest year in the historical record in the United States. We're in this situation where we're getting this sort of erratic, careening from sort of one – or careering, I guess, from sort of one weather extreme to the other. But globally, this year will wind up being sort of number – 7 or 8 maybe on the all-time list of warmest years. I mean, we're at a point already where, all 10 of the warmest years in the historical record have happened within the last 15 years, since 1998. So now some people, sort of climate skeptics, make the argument, well, global warming has stopped. That's not really true. It has slowed down in the last 15 years compared to what we were getting through the 90s. And we're only increasing sort of at less than half the speed that we were in the 90s. But it's not like things are cooling off. All the recent years are the warmest in the historical record.
But what ramifications does this mean for our kids if the coldest year will be warmer than the hottest years from the past? What does that portend here for us?
I think we're looking at some pretty big stresses on society potentially. Last year might be a good example where you had a heat wave in the middle part of the country that compared to what we were expecting at the beginning of last year sort of knocked the corn crop down by 27% or something, as I recall. And we had one of the worst corn crops in recent American history. This year we're having the very best. We're in the situation of just bouncing from sort of one extreme to another. But I think what you can expect in the future, if the scientists are anywhere close to right about this, is a rising stress on society in terms of food supply, a rising stress in terms of heat damage and things like that. And there's not much question we're going to have to sort of adapt to that and figure out ways to cope with it.
Justin Gillis is one of the authors of an e-book, Temperature Rising. It's a series in the New York Times from earlier this year. It's now an e-book, and it's available at newyorktimes.com, I think, right?
And on Amazon and iTunes and all of those.
You know, in our conversation here, Justin, I'm looking for a glimmer of good news, and I'm not finding it. Am I wrong?
There's not a lot of good news in the field of global warming. If you remember that cartoon character who walked around with the sort of black cloud over his head, that's sort of how I feel these
Pig
days.
Pen,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. That said, I mean, it's not as if there's no progress. I mean, emissions are falling in the United States, for example. They're falling in Europe.
But not around the world in total, though, right? Aren't it's still going up?
That's
Those emissions
correct.
Are still rising.
It's still going up. And to some extent, the idea that they're falling in the wealthy countries is a bit of an illusion. I mean, we're buying, the iPads and iPods and all that stuff that's being made in China. And so the emissions are from those products, really, a lot of the emissions. So you really do have to look at the sort of global scale. The appearance that things are falling is just really partly a change in where stuff is being manufactured.
To get from where we are now as a global community to where we need to be, at least in the eyes of environmental scientists, how big of a leap is that?
It's a pretty big leap. We are beginning to decarbonize, is the phrase in the West, reduce the sort of carbon intensity of our economy. But as we just mentioned, it's still going up, as a result of the growth in the developing countries. Even in the West, to get to where the scientists think we need to be by 2050, which is at near zero on emissions, we really need to be decarbonizing several times faster than we are. And we haven't even begun decarbonization in sort of China and countries like that. And there's a major question of whether they can do that. You know, are there alternatives that they can that would allow them to do so? Those countries are most focused on growth and climbing out of poverty.
To what extent is global warming sort of make up your the chief topic in your portfolio of being an environmental writer? Is this really sort of primary topic A1 for Justin Gillis?
It's 100% of what I do. Yeah,
100% now.
Yeah. I'm a full-time writer on climate change, essentially science writer on climate change. There are not that many in the world. You would think a problem this big would have sort of hundreds of people focused on it, but it does not. For general interest sort of news audiences, I can name maybe half a dozen people who are focused on it in the world.
I want to read the lead of another piece you had in the Times just this month, Justin. It begins this way. Climate change will pose sharp risks to the world's food supply in coming decades, potentially undermining crop production and driving up prices at a time when the demand for food is expected to soar. The scientists concluded that rising temperatures will have some beneficial effects on crops in some places, but that globally they will make it harder for crops to thrive, perhaps reducing production overall by as much as 2% each decade for the rest of this century. That doesn't sound very good.
It's not good.
And the population's rising.
Population's rising. Food demand is rising. Food demand is rising now faster than population because as people climb out of poverty, you know, one of the first things they do is start to eat better and they want, you know, something other than rice in the bowl every evening. This is an interesting and large change from where the science was just a few years ago. I mean, a lot of people sort of argue, these scientists are being alarmists. And, you know, some people even say, oh, this is all a big sort of hoax. Well, the truth is, up until a few years ago, the scientists were pretty sanguine about our chances on the food supply. They thought there would be problems, maybe big problems in the tropics, but that would be compensated in the northern latitudes by, you know, things grow better up to a point when it's warmer if in a cold climate, and also compensated by as the carbon dioxide level rises. You know, that's what's causing global warming, but it also kind of boosts the plant growth. We're now starting to think, and this has been a big change in the science just in the last few years, that those pluses will not outweigh the minuses of sort of extra heat, extra drought, and all that sort of stuff. And so there's a big, big question here of whether we can meet food demand. You may remember in 2000, we already had a little foretaste of what might be coming with the sort of food crisis in 2008. A few bad harvests, and we were suddenly in a serious situation. There were riots in 30 countries. The government of Haiti fell as a result of that. This is not a sort of stable system that we're dealing with already, and we're looking at the stresses on it increasing through time.
You know, you can't help but wonder, Justin, what the impact of what you're saying will be here in the heartland, you know, which in places has suffered enormously from severe drought in recent years. And I'm thinking primarily of the western half of Kansas. Man, I mean, you just feel for the farmers out there.
Yeah, although they're in the middle of their sort of best year right now, following on one of their worst years in recent history. I think a lot of farmers are sort of now. So a lot of them, you know, let's be honest, sort of aren't convinced that climate change is real. They may be convinced the temperature rise is real, but think it's part of a natural cycle or something like that. I meet a lot of farmers though who are sort of scratching their heads, you know, saying there is something going on here, and we don't quite understand it. So some of their views are changing or evolving.
The news release for your talk said that you have raised hackles by comparing global warming skeptics to opponents of evolution, evolution being a very big topic out here in the heartland. First, whose hackles have you raised?
The folks that question climate science are not exactly the same folks who question evolution. I mean, there is some overlap between those two groups. But a lot of the people who question climate science are essentially libertarians or economic conservatives whose real fear, whose real concern is not the science. Their real concern is the policy proposals for dealing with the science, you know, mm-hmm. potentially higher taxes on carbon-based fuels and that sort of thing. And many of them, in fact, are perfectly fine with evolution science because it doesn't lead you any place having to do with taxes or what they would perceive to be economic liberty. So they get upset at being compared to evolution deniers. I think it's a fair comparison in the sense that you have just a mountain – in both cases, you have just a mountain of scientific evidence that the problem is real, or in the case of evolution, that evolution did happen. You know, we go dig up the dinosaur bones on a pretty regular basis. You have to be coming from a sort of a tendentious state of mind to look at that mountain of evidence and say, oh, no, that's not real. And some people look at climate science right now and say, oh, it's a massive global hoax, you know, as if that were some, you know, as if it were plausible that, you know, thousands of scientists around the world would get together and concoct a hoax.
If you're joining us now, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting with Justin Gillis. He's an environmental reporter for the New York Times. He is one of just a handful of reporters on the globe who covers climate change full time for his newspaper. You wrote this in June, Justin. Already, you wrote, glaciers are melting, heat waves and heavy rains are increasing. The food system is under stress and the sea is rising. The best that can be hoped for, scientists say, is to limit the damage or slow it enough to provide society more time to adjust. So again, we can't completely halt global warming.
That's pretty clear at this point. There's so much greenhouse gas in the air already in the atmosphere that it appears that very big changes are inevitable. And the question is just how big are they going to be and how fast are they going to come on us?
Let's take these things at a time. The glaciers are melting, you wrote. In 5 years, will this planet still have glaciers?
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, it doesn't happen that quickly.
20 years?
Oh, yeah. We will have glaciers somewhere in 1,000 years, I have no doubt.
Because you get a sense that they're disappearing for good. At least that's the sense you get from reading sometimes.
Well, it's certainly a bellwether indicator that that the climate system is now out of balance, that you can go almost anywhere on this planet and the land ice is melting. But, you know, there's some very big so – now, if you talk about the big ice caps, certainly Greenland and Antarctica, it would take an awful long time to melt those. We it would seem we're going to do it. We're going to melt parts of them anyway. But I've seen this with my own eyes. I've seen this in South America. I've seen this in New Zealand. I've seen this in Greenland. Anywhere you go, you can see evidence in front of your eyes that the glaciers are starting to melt.
And the consequence of that, and you write about this, is rising sea levels. What does that mean? Translate that for us. What's the consequence of that?
It's important to understand sort of, sea level has always been unstable in the history of the Earth. In fact, at the end of the last ice age, the sea level apparently rose by about 400 feet. And this is only 20,000 years ago.
Huh.
What's happened is that essentially instantaneously billions of us have shown up on this planet, with a couple of billion settling on the coast, sort of looking at the ocean and saying, you can no longer move. And I think the ocean is not listening. The ocean is going to obey the laws of physics. It's not going to obey the decrees from the North Carolina legislature that it not move, for example. So this is not going to be sort of real fast on the human time scale. Mm-hmm. One of the things you got to learn to do here is think about what happens on the human time scale versus the geological time scale. I mean, the scientists are now saying, just recently they said, probably the most sea level rise we could get by the end of the century is 3 feet. But that'd be quite a bit if that happened. I mean, you're talking about Much more frequent coastal flooding. You're really talking probably about people being driven away from the coast by events like Hurricane Sandy happening sort of more and more often.
Lots of beachfront hotels in our endangered species now.
Certainly over the long term they are. How quickly it'll happen, we don't really know. 3 feet will be just the beginning. It looks like we may be due at this current level of greenhouse gas, we may be due for sort of 15 or 20 feet of sea level rise over time. It's just a question of how fast that's going to play out, how long does human society have to adjust to it, and how intelligently do we sort of cope with the situation? Right now, you and I are subsidizing to a massive degree for people to build near the coast and to go back in and rebuild after these events. And you can sort of debate whether we should be subsidizing that. Does that make any sense?
We're visiting with Justin Gillis, who covers global climate change for the New York Times. Justin, what kind of leader, in your view, has Barack Obama when it comes to the environment?
Rather than speak from my point of view, I guess I want to sort of translate
sure.
what the scientists
That's
and
fine.
the activists would say here. They would tell you they feel like Mr. Obama's heart is in the right place. He ran on this issue as a sort of major part of his campaign. They made a big push in his first year in office to get a bill through Congress. It passed the House. It died in the Senate in part because of opposition from Democrats, from coal-dependent states, not just Republicans. And it died pretty narrowly. So the administration made a push. It fell short. The political circumstances of the last few years have really limited what they can do or what they can try to do. The president has said – the Supreme Court has ruled that he actually has some power under the Clean Air Act to do something about this.
And he's taken advantage of that, right?
And he's basically said to Congress, look, if you won't do this
– I'll do it through executive order.
I will through executive order. And, lots of people don't like, that he's trying to do it administratively. But we've got a Supreme Court ruling that says he's got the power to do that. And so the question right now – and we're probably not going to know for another – 9 months or a year, is just exactly how bold is he going to be? How strong is he going to be when he comes out with a policy? Is he willing to sort of pick the political fight of actually shutting down, for example, coal-burning power plants? Or will they in the end sort of come up with something weaker than that?
He set this goal, just a final thing, Justin, by reducing greenhouse gas emissions in this country by 17% by 2020 compared with the level back in 2005. Are we going to get there?
We may get there. Emissions are declining in this country to a substantial extent because of this newfound abundance of natural gas that we have from hydraulic fracturing. And when you displace coal and burn natural gas for your power generation instead, it's about half as much carbon dioxide. So we might get there, but the truth is it's not a very ambitious goal. Mr. Obama moved the goalposts a bit. Most countries are using 1990 as their baseline. If you use 1990 as your baseline, the promise he's made only amounts to about a 4% cut from where we were then. So back to the original point that, yes, we're beginning to decarbonize, but not fast enough.
A long way to go.
Long way to go.
Justin, what a pleasure.
Thank
you. Enjoyed having you.
Thank you
so much.
Enjoyed it.